You're tuned to 90.5 WICN, Jazz Plus for New England. You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Listen online at wicn.org. Good evening, I'm Al Voner, and this is The Public Eye. Nice to have everybody with us this Sunday evening. You know about my fetish of being a history buff. Well, it continues. But this was an interesting book that came across my desk recently. The title of the book is Drug Addiction in America, and the time period is 1776 through 1914, and my guest is Elizabeth Kelly Gray. She is the author and educator, and the book is really amazing because when we think of drug addiction, we think, well, I guess that started around the 1950s or the 1960s, and we've seen a proliferation of that across the country and the globe. But Kelly's book really does go back a long way and talks about the origins of drug abuse, drug addiction as it played out in this country. So that's why I asked her to be our guest this evening, and a welcoming addition to this week's edition of The Public Eye. Kelly, nice to have you with us.
Thank you so much. I'm happy to be here.
As I said, I mean, if you were to ask me, just if we were to bump into each other in general conversation and say, you know, drug addiction's really, you know, rampant in this country, I say, yeah, you know, I think it started, around the 60s with all the turmoil on college campuses and everything. That would be my initial reaction. But after reading your book, I'm thinking, wow, way back when the colonies were, you know, 1776, the formation of this country, there was drug addiction. What, where, how, when did this all come about? But your research indicates that, there was quite a bit of drug addiction in this country early on, correct?
There certainly was. And most of the, overwhelmingly, the early cases of addiction, or they referred to it as habitual use. They thought of it as a bad habit. But it began with what we would think of as prescription drug abuse, that the most widely used drug at the time would be forms of opiates, drugs that come from the opium poppy. A popular one was called laudanum, which was a combination of opium and alcohol and spices, and it was effective in terms of as a pain reliever. It was also effective in terms of helping people to sleep, and so it was something that could be widely used both for someone who had almost any illness or injury, and it was also something that people would keep on hand in the family, you know, the equivalent of the family medicine cabinet. And so people would be using it for pain relief to help them sleep. And then there would be some people who either would realize that they would realize these sort of, effects that they could get from it, the sort of euphoria that they could sometimes experience, and would therefore continue taking it to experience that. And for others, if they were using it for a while, and then they stopped, they would experience what we would recognize as withdrawal symptoms. They didn't exactly realize what was going on, and so they would keep taking it to avoid those. So there were people who would become addicted, and the thing is that for the vast majority of the time that I'm focusing on in my book, these drugs were not regulated at the national level. State laws and municipal laws were sometimes, you know, not well enforced. So essentially, anyone who needed the drug could go and get more of it. They weren't terribly expensive. So you do end up with these cases. And again, it wasn't really connected with crime or even really noticed, but it was certainly there.
I the other question I had for you, and in reading the book, it certainly came to mind several times. We think today, as you said, there's many laws on the books prohibiting the use of various drugs, and that's been in place for quite a while. But we also use the word recreational today. Back yes. then, as you talked about, most of these drugs were used to counter illness or whatnot. So, but was there any percentage in the early days of people just using it for the sake of getting high, recreational use?
It's such a good question. What we have evidence is medical use and what I would call restorative use, which would be if someone's had a rough day or, you know, if someone is sort of dealing with adversity, but the person isn't sick, they might take it for that. In terms of recreational use, it's interesting because it is something that we don't entirely see. We see a couple of cases, for example, of women who almost used it as an, I guess, an early version of Valium or something, something that would help them not really mind things. Now, one thing that happens in 1821, there's an Englishman named Thomas De Quincey who wrote a book called Confessions of an English Opium Eater. And drug addiction in America was not really recognized in the press at that time, but many Americans thought that Confessions of an English opium eater was this sort of fascinating work. And in it, he describes how he would, for example, he began taking it for medical purposes and then experienced this euphoria. And then he would say things that he would take it before going to the opera and it heightened his enjoyment of the opera, things like that. So they were aware of it in some cases, but they regarded this as sort of this interesting story from abroad.
Yeah.
So recreational use is something that we see a little bit of sort of experimentation by doctors where they are literally, you know, experimenting with drugs. But it seemed to be overwhelmingly that the focus was either on medical use or, again, what I would call restorative use, and real criticism when it was used purely as an indulgence, which we see more prominently in the early 20th century.
Right. So it wasn't what, so the recreational, if for lack of another term, wasn't widespread. I got to ask you, now you're on the faculty of Towson University in Maryland. So let me ask you, I mean, this is out of the, you know, when people think of history, they think, well, yeah, you know, you're talking about, the colonial times and our break from Britain or World War II. I mean, all those major things that we learned from our early days in grammar school. This is somewhat of a departure. Drug addiction in America, going back as far as you did, not only because I'm sure it piqued your interest, but I'm sure you talk about this with many of your students. Has this been a popular topic?
Yes. I've a few times I have taught a course that was about the history of drug addiction and drug policy in America, where I began in the colonial era and came up to the I think the course came up to the 1990s or so, and it is something that has traditionally only gotten a couple of maybe glimpses. For example, I mean, there is attention oftentimes to alcohol and to the temperance movement of the 19th century. In the 1840s, Great Britain and China fought what became known as an opium war because British merchants were bringing lots of opium into China, which was having a negative effect on the population. But I find that by including all these others, it is something that not only really interests the students, but it's also something that is, I find, a really useful or interesting way to connect it with other themes of the time. For example, the major legislation when the U.S. does decide to have regulation at the national level of drugs is part of the progressive era reforms of the time. So I'm able to draw those connections, but the class certainly did fill up quickly, every time I've offered it.
Well, you know, because it's so prevalent across the globe today, there's no sense in hiding it anymore. Everybody from the time that they're very young knows somebody, a friend, a relative, high schools, grammar schools, middle schools, you hear somebody, using drug or, even having it cause physical harm to themselves. So it's not something new anymore. But I love the tie-in that, hey, guess what? This is not something that's a new phenomenon in the last few decades. This goes back a long way, but it has evolved and it has grown into what we're dealing with today. I just want to take a quick pause to remind listeners that you're tuned to 90.5 WICN, Jazz Plus for New England. You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Listen online at WICN.org. I'm Al Vona, host of The Public Eye. Nice to have you with us. My guest this week is Kelly Gray, and she is the author of the new book, Drug Addiction in America, the years 1776 to 1914. And yes, that is correct, 1776. Many people thinking that drug addiction, drug use, recreational drug, whatever you want to call it, is a fairly new phenomenon. No, it is not. It had its origins way back in the early stages of this country. Kelly, another question I had to ask, as you talked about, early on there were no real laws, no real medical warnings. But the other thing that caught my interest in the book, And I wanted to ask you about this. Historical figures, prominent figures in American history. Did you come across many that were also users of this, whether it be for medical reasons or, as you said, just to take the edge off?
There are some. For example, the laudanum and other opiates were effective pain relievers. So, for example, it is something that Benjamin Franklin used in his later days, and would say how he was grateful for it because it relieved his pain. Laudanum after the duel between Alexander Hamilton and Aaron Burr, laudanum is among the treatments that Alexander Hamilton received, and so we do have that. There was a political figure in Virginia named John Randolph, who was ill for most of his life. And after he died, which was, I believe, in the 1830s, it was revealed that he had been using laudanum a good bit. And it's also something that was, in a couple of cases, used as sort of a way of accusing someone. There was one case where one politician, I think it was, had heard a rumor that Alexander Hamilton spoke eloquently because he was using opium. The idea was that it would help people to be sort of more eloquent, that it would help them sometimes in social situations, and so it comes to be used. And I remember one was criticizing or alleging that this was something Alexander Hamilton did, and that in essence was this sort of artificial assistance that he had in terms of his speech.
Yeah, I mean that makes sense. I mean, especially at that time in history, people took it as gospel, and if they thought they could enhance, as you said, their social mobility, their ability to mix and mingle with various groups of people, then I'm sure many, many people were on board. Going back to, again, breaking it down by, let's say, in this case, genders. Men obviously were allowed more freedom, more latitude back then than women. So were they more likely to use various drugs as opposed to women, or not necessarily?
It's such an interesting point. It actually, if we look at the number of people who became addicted to opiates in the 19th century, it actually is more women. Mm. And the reason for this, a couple of reasons. One is that the vast majority of addiction did begin with people using it medically. And one thing is that especially in the sort of the latter half of the 19th century, doctors were extensively overprescribing morphine, which is an active ingredient in opium. And the reason was that it provided this quick relief. It made the patient happy, the patient's family happy. And there was one doctor at the end of the century who estimated that as much as 90% of the cases of addiction had originated with a visit to a doctor, and they realized they better change their ways. But it was primarily women who went to doctors because, to a degree, it was seen as that a man should just sort of tough it out and not not go to a doctor if he were ill. And with women, there was no opposition like that. And it also is the fact that it was unseemly for a woman to drink. So if she found some sort of euphoria with an opiate, she could keep taking it, and people would assume she's, for all they know, she's taking it for medical purposes. And also, there were many ailments that women had that had no real treatment or cure, and so doctors would prescribe it. So there does become this association of, in particular, the typical person addicted to a drug in that latter half of the 19th century would have been a middle class woman whose use had begun with a trip to a doctor.
And I assume that along with that, they didn't have to harbor people ostracizing them or condemning them or saying, you're a druggie. That's the kind of one of the words we use today.
Right. Exactly, and that was, and it, exactly, and part of it was that when someone was using an opiate. They were accepted and widely used as medicine, and no one could really tell why they were using it. And it's also the fact that, you know, I mean, if a person drinks too much, the person might be very conspicuous and loud or combative, but people who used opiates tended to use them alone, and they would become sort of passive. Mm. So they didn't really get attention. One thing that I was realizing in the midst of this project, there's sort of this image of the late 19th century of the invalid, someone who was, you know, confined, sometimes men, sometimes women, confined to their bed with bottles on the bed table. And I do wonder for how many of those that was really an opiate addiction.
Yeah.
And again, it's sometimes hard to discern, but in some cases, it would really only be members of the immediate family who might realize, because the person wasn't really able to, you know, to do as much.
Right. I agree. I mean, I was thinking about that myself, that, you know, how many people actually understood that many of these people, that's their day-to-day ritual, and it's what's keeping them, I guess, I don't want to necessarily say alive, but keeping them pain-free, if you will. Another question I had for you today is, we know, globally, I'm not pointing a finger at any one group of people or any one nation, but you know, drug cartels, drug monopolies, today illegal drugs, millions if not billions of dollars are being made. Did it ever get out of hand? Now, as you've been talking up to this point, you know, they would go to a doctor, and doctor would prescribe, the opium or something to take the edge off. Did it ever get to the point where somebody, some entrepreneurial mindset said, you know what, I don't need a doctor. If I can get my hands on that stuff and just peddle it to the general public for a profit, I might be sitting pretty here. Was any of that going on?
We see that. It's interesting because part of it is that can't, it really, we first really see this in the late 1910s, and that's because up until then, the drugs were legal at the national level. There were no regulations, and so there wasn't really that opportunity as much. And there's sort of two pieces to it. In the 1910s, the Harrison Act is passed, which says that people can only get opiates or cocaine if they have a documented medical need and a doctor provides a prescription. And before then, people could just go into a drugstore with the money. And so at that point, we see the creation of what we would really think of as an illicit market that's charging exorbitant prices, and people are resorting to theft, et cetera, to get money to buy it. And the only thing, other example of this would be in the 1870s or so, it had been a case earlier that if someone wanted an opiate, they would go to the druggist in their town who they've known for a while, and they would buy it, and they've got it. And by the later 19th century, with innovations in transportation and manufacturing, that you have companies beginning to make these, a lot of snake oil type of products, and they didn't have to tell what was in them. And so newspapers would be full of ads. And for example, there might be an ad for a treatment for morphine addiction, and what it contains is morphine. And so the person is taking it and thinks, you know, wow, you know, oh, I feel so much better. Well, that was because that's what they were taking. And these are sent across the country. The person who's buying it has no idea who they're really buying from. The name is fake, et cetera. And so you have people, you have, you know, charlatans sort of taking advantage of that opportunity. Mm-hmm. And then in 1906, with the Pure Food and Drug Act, one of the pieces of that law was that anyone who sells a medicine has to indicate on the packaging what the ingredients are. And so that sort of goes away. So you have that opportunity that some take, but it's interesting because it's in the late 1910s. There was one man who was writing for a publication, and he said something like, there is now a connection between drug addiction and crime in terms of the illicit market, and people all of a sudden needing a lot more money if they wanted to buy something than they would have had to have. And it's something that had not been there for all that time, and then it emerges.
Yeah, that's what I was, you know, that was my next question to you, is that over time, especially someone who had been a man or woman, a habitual user, it made them feel good. They felt that, you know, I can't live without this, so that there would be a desperation, if you will, in some cases, if they were without it, or a craving, and it would certainly drive a market or allow for illicit opportunities for many of these people. When someone got to that point, and you talked about somebody just lying in bed 24/7, requiring whatever they had by their bedside, thinking that this is the only way I can get on, this is the only way I can live. And even for those who weren't, bedridden, it had to be many people out there who got addictions or got addicted to, as you said, in this case, opium. Was there any recognizing of the fact that these people are now addicted? How do we get them off? Is there any possible way of weaning them off? Or they just live the rest of their life as dependent on the drugs?
It's such an interesting debate with this, because what happens is the perception in the late 19th century had been that there were these middle-class women who became addicted to morphine. They got a lot of public sympathy when there were references, a lot of sympathy. And doctors stopped prescribing it to the women. By the early 20th century, the increasing focus in terms of cases of addiction was the perception that it was a young man who lived in a city who was addicted to heroin. Mm. And the idea that it was that their use of it was indulgent, meaning, you know, recreational rather than having derived from medical need. Now, one thing I do want to emphasize is sometimes there's this perception that the response for those whose use was medical was one thing, and those whose use was more indulgent or recreational was more critical. It really is a good bit of it is really more along lines of racism and classism really shaped perceptions of who could use a drug and who should not. Mm-hmm. But by the time we get to the 1910s, the idea was that if someone had a legitimate medical need, they could still get their drug. And there was really, I think, on the part of others, the idea that either addiction was something that they could cure easily, that someone could end their use easily, or really not being terribly concerned if the people were suffering because of a widely held belief that it was something, in a sense, that they had brought on themselves. And so we see this kind of approach and not really taking into account that the growth of an illicit market would be something that would be a significant problem. There were a couple of people who were suggesting that someone really could end their use in a week or two if they tried. And there were still many people who believed that this was a matter of willpower, that someone just had to kind of, you know, summon that willpower, and that person would then be able to end their use. And sometimes there were people who were addicted who thought it themselves and couldn't understand why they couldn't. Now, addiction, ongoing use, really does change the brain, so it's a more complicated story. But the perception was that people should be able to just sort of, in this case, tough it out, and that helped build support. The Supreme Court was asked with regard to the Harrison Law, what if someone is addicted? Is that considered a legitimate circumstance for medical treatment? And the Supreme Court said it was not, that the goal had to be, you know, that everyone should end up being drug free.
Yeah, easier said than done. With the few moments that we have left, I've got to ask you again, with this, you know, with this uptick, with this proliferation as time went on, was there in this country, and it's pretty much well documented today from coast to coast, that there is a correlation between drug abuse and crime. Was there ever any statistics? Was there anybody mapping out the fact that, well, you know, some of these people who really don't need this and now just using it for the sake of feeling good, and when they can't get it, they'll break into a neighbor's home or, you know, cause crime or harm to another? Was there any correlation, I guess what I'm saying, between the drug use and crime back then?
What they see happening is they do see it happening, but there was one policeman who in New York City was in charge of what they refer to as the dope squad, and he says that the well-to-do people could still get access, And he, and I mean, I'm quoting him, he says something like, the people we call the bums are the ones who can't. Mm. And so there is that growth in crime. But again, what, and it's recognized as a problem, but what we see time and again, and this goes then through the, you know, through the 20th century, is that along lines to a large extent of race and class, there are some people who are identified, largely members of the white middle class, as being allowed to keep the drug, to either keep access to their drug that they need it medically, or that they should be receive extensive assistance to end their use, and others, people of color in many cases, and also people who are not middle class, don't have that option, and so there is that rise in crime that gets documented. And as I say, in the late 1910s, there were people who were predicting this and who were saying that they were calling, for example, for things like wider access to health care, because they said that many of these people had illnesses, diseases that were not being treated, and therefore they were self-medicating. And they're making these suggestions, but it does create, and I've found this, and other historians have found this, where it in essence creates two classes of people who were addicted, and one group gets sympathy and treatment, and the other is treated with the criminal justice system.
Yeah, amazing. I mean, the book is fascinating. You don't have to be a historian. You don't have to be a history buff, because it's an issue that has touched lives right here as we live today, in the year 2023. But the origins, and that's what really caught my eye. I say Kelly's book goes back to a time when most people would think, oh, well, they didn't have those kind of issues back then. They did indeed. In fact, it was probably the foundation of what is taking place here today. Kelly, if people want to reach out to you directly, post questions, find out more about your research, the work you did in putting together Drug Addiction in America, how may they reach you?
I'd be happy to have them contact me. The best way would probably be my my email address, and that's it's egray@towson.edu, and that's egray@towson.edu.
And again, the book, the title of the book, Drug Addiction in America, the years 1776 through 1914, Kelly's in-depth research, bringing to light the fact that, both for medical purposes and as we've been talking about this evening, and even recreational, had its foundations early on in the early days of this country. So not necessarily a new phenomenon in the last few decades. This really has its origins going way, way back. So very interesting, very enlightening. I really enjoyed reading the book. Any questions about the broadcast, you can certainly give us a call here at the studios at WICN. We certainly welcome that. The number is 508-752-0700. You can pose any comments, questions, or feedback to me directly. I certainly welcome that. That's Al Vona, V-U-O-N-A, at WICN.org. Again, for the public eye, I want to thank my guest, Kelly Gray. The new book is Drug Addiction in America, and we hope to have you back next week. For the public eye, this is Al Vona. Thank you so much for tuning in.